Greetings once again to you, my fellow man. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney, coming to you for another week on the show, where we don't take calls and we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought for your entertainment and edification. Glad to have you back on board this week, and I've got so much news, there's no way I'm going to get to it all. Flipping through, there's just no way I'm going to get to it all, so I'm going to jump right in. We're going to start out with doubts and questions that have begun to surface over the qualifications of one Judge Sotomayor. What was her first name? Sonia, with an I, not a J. Sonia Sotomayor, people are beginning to question whether or not she may be qualified to be on the Supreme Court. And I just have to remind everyone that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is already sitting as a justice on the Supreme Court. And I mean, this chick is a flaming leftist, baby-killing, boy-drugging, girl-defiling, twisted, angry, ugly feminist wench. That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so to assume that Ms. Sotomayor is not qualified, well, one must go back and look at the record. Look what we've got there already, for crying out loud. So funny, got an email from a listener in the United Kingdom, a show that I co-hosted with Bob Enyard a week or two ago, where Bob turned Sotomayor's racist comment back on the racists themselves by making a similar comment about white men, stating that a white male should indeed be able to render a better decision than a minority female because of the inherent superiority of white males. Anyway, a listener over in the UK was actually offended, and I'm quite proud that Bob and I pulled that off so well, that we actually fooled that guy. Anyway, we've put out the fire there. He understands that we were illustrating racism by turning a racist quote back on the very racists that have interpreted the quotes of one Sonia with an I, not a J, Sotomayor. But let's move off of Sotomayor. Last night, my wife and I are watching the local news, which I know some people laugh. But, you know, we watch the weather. We want to know the weather. And so we're watching local news on the local Fox 31 station. And a kid had a bicycle accident. And he was impaled, I say, on his bicycle. And he was rushed to the hospital. And fortunately, the portion of the bike that was impaling his body did no damage to any major organs. And the kid survived. And the kid's mom, it was just funny, she said that, she basically said that the location of the impalement wound, is that the way to, an impalement wound? I don't know. Is that how you say that? Anyway, she said the location of the impalement wound was a blessing. I'm thinking, your kid was impaled on a bicycle. How is any part of that a blessing? I mean, sure, the bike didn't puncture his heart or his liver or his kidneys, but to call that a blessing, I don't know. I suppose at least she's giving God some of the credit. I mean, maybe she's a Calvinist type, and she thinks that God caused the accident, and then, I guess, just for the opportunity of giving the blessing of having it miss his pancreas and his liver. I don't know. Anyway, I just thought that was odd that your kid is impaled on a bike, makes the local news, and you consider the location of the wound a blessing. But anyway, let's move on to the hard news of the day, of the week even. We'll look at some news of the past week, and we will divine some of the news for the week to come. Dateline Washington, D.C., from the Reuters Wire, a former U.S. State Department official and his wife have been arrested for spying for the Cuban government for nearly 30 years. Yes, Walter Kendall Myers, aided by his wife Gwendolyn, used his top-secret clearance to pass on classified information to the Cuban government, and at one point apparently met with Cuban leader Fidel Castro himself. Yes. Now, the two were charged, according to the Reuters story, with a number of counts. Conspiracy to act as illegal agents of the Cuban government, and to communicate classified information to Cuba, and wire fraud, and acting as illegal agents. Now, that's a little confusing. I mean, wouldn't the charge of acting as illegal agents, wouldn't that supersede the charge of conspiracy to act as illegal agents? I mean, They were helping Cuba spy for 30 years, so I think they acted. I don't think they just conspired to act. I think they acted for, well, for a good 30 years, it would appear. Anyway, and I'm reading this, I'm thinking, is there not a charge of treason anymore? I mean, wouldn't that be simpler? One charge, treason. Oh, well. You know, in our comically tragic justice system, prosecutors apparently have to just constantly play a game of judicial twister, you know, to be able to be sure they can convict these people on something. I mean, anyway, they're probably going to meet with President Obama at some point in the near future so they can trade, so they can give him some tips on etiquette when he goes down to meet Castro. Has he met with Castro yet? I don't think he's met with Castro. He met with the other nutcase down in Venezuela, but I don't think he's met with Castro yet. So he'll have to sit down with Walt and Gwendolyn and find out what kind of gifts to what to put on the iPod that they give to Fidel. I don't know. Anyway, let's move into the politics file. Dateline Beijing, China. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner reaffirmed his faith in a strong dollar and reassured the Chinese government that its huge holdings of dollar-denominated assets are safe. Geithner said, quote, "We believe in a strong dollar," unquote. And by the way, he was speaking at a question and answer session after a speech he gave to students at Peking University. A major goal, according to the Reuters story, of Geithner's maiden visit to China as Treasury Secretary is to allay Beijing's concerns that Washington's mushrooming budget deficit and ultra-loose monetary policy will undermine both the dollar and U.S. bonds. China, Reuters points out, is the biggest foreign owner of U.S. Treasury bonds. To quote Mr. Geithner again, the young Mr. Geithner, quote, "Chinese financial assets are very safe," unquote. His response, that response, drew laughter from the audience. And so, folks, the children in charge of our monetary policy, they can't even put it over on a bunch of college kids in China. They're laughing him off the stage. Yet the mainstream media, everything that Geithner and Obama says is practically treated as gospel. That's right, I said the mainstream media, because I believe they're all on psychoactive medications, everyone in the news media. Every single one of them should be drug tested. From now on, we will refer to them as the mainstream media. And so let's continue. Let's continue in the politics file. From Hugo Chavez himself, Dateline Caracas, Venezuela, from the Reuters Wire, Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez said that he and Cuban ally Fidel Castro risk being more conservative than U.S. President Barack Obama as Washington prepares to take control of General Motors. Yes, the Venezuelan leader made reference to GM's bankruptcy filing, which, as you know, is expected to give the U.S. government a 60% stake in General Motors, a 100-year-old icon of American might and industriousness. A 60% stake by the United States government. Chavez says, "Hey, Obama has just nationalized nothing more and nothing less than General Motors. Comrade Obama! Fidel, careful or we're going to end up to his right. Ha, ha, ha. Cha, cha, cha." Yeah, that's Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez. During a decade in government, Reuters tells us, Chavez has nationalized most of Venezuela's key economic sectors, including multi-billion-dollar oil projects, often joint ventures with the private sector, that give the state a 60% controlling stake. So Obama, following the lead of the people who basically formed his political worldview, one Fidel Castro and one Hugo Chavez. All right, now moving from politics, we're going to jump into the international file quickly. Dateline Tehran, that's in Iran, for all of you publicly educated and public school educators. Iran's hardline president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is seeking a second term in office, reiterated on Wednesday his anti-Israel stance by calling the Holocaust, quote, a big deception. Ahmadinejad also said liberal democracies of the world have degraded human values. The Iranian state television news website quoted him as saying, quote, The identity of the liberal democracy has been exposed to the world by its protection of the most criminal regime in the history of humanity, the Zionist regime, by using the big deception of the Holocaust. Okay, Mr. Ahmadinejad, flatly disagree with you on that particular point. A second quote from Mahmoud. There is no doubt that the only way to replace the liberal thought is to go back to the teachings of the divine prophets, Ahmadinejad said. Okay. Flatly disagree with point number two from Mr. Ahmadinejad, because the holy prophets to which, the divine prophets, I'm sorry, to which he refers are just pagan, frankly. Pagan myths, one might say. One might even call it a big deception. But let's move on to the third quote from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The thoughts and the system of liberal regimes have lowered the benchmarks for human perfection. The liberal regimes cannot solve the simplest of the political issues in the world. Now, on that last point, I must admit that Mr. Ahmadinejad has the liberal democracies nailed. They can't solve even the simplest of political issues in the world. I hate to agree with Mahmoud, but at least on that one small thin point, he definitely has the liberal democracies of the West nailed to a T. Ahmadinejad, by the way, was speaking to a gathering of 600 international scholars who have arrived in Tehran to mark the 20th anniversary of the death of the founder of the Islamic Republic. You remember the ever-popular Ayatollah Khomeini. And just wanted to end that story on a happy note, reminding everyone that Ayatollah Khomeini is dead. Now let's move into the politics file. From the Associated Press, we're going to talk about Mr. Barack Hussein Obama and his feelings on the atomic aspirations of the Islamic Republic of Iran. President Barack Obama, according to the AP, reiterated that Iran may have some right to nuclear energy, provided it takes steps to prove its aspirations are peaceful. The comments echo remarks Obama made in Prague last month, in which he said his administration would, quote, support Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy with rigorous inspection, unquote, if Iran proves it is no longer a nuclear threat. Yes, Obama told the BBC, quote, what we want to do is open a dialogue. You know, there are misapprehensions about the West on the part of the Muslim world, and obviously there are some big misapprehensions about the Muslim world when it comes to those of us in the West. By the way, for all of you public school educators, a misapprehension is commonly translated as a misunderstanding. Yes, a misunderstanding. Is that what you think, Mr. Barack Hussein Obama? Let's see, what else is in the story from the AP? Obama said he hoped to deliver the message that democratic values are principles that, quote, Muslims can embrace and affirm. Obama said, there is a danger when the United States or any country thinks that we can simply impose these values on another country with a different history and different culture. Well, so back to the misapprehensions, Mr. Obama. They understand that the West is basically degrading civilized culture, yeah, you know, via the export of immoral entertainment, you know. They understand that they hate the Christian church and they hate Jesus Christ, and we understand that they follow a pagan religion founded on murder and bloodshed. So if there are misunderstandings, Mr. Obama, I believe that we can lay those at your feet. Not, at least not here at the Weekly Worldview. We have no misapprehensions about Islam. But we do feel strongly here that secular humanism, the religion to which Mr. Barack Hussein Barryho Obama ascribes, is far more dangerous than Islam. Far more dangerous. And we'll probably be able to prove that to some degree as the show moves forward. Now, back into the... into the politics file, every time I see this name, I chuckle. This is a story related directly to Mr. Albert Gore. From the Agence France-Presse, the United States might send former U.S. President Al Gore to Pyongyang in order to negotiate the release of two American journalists on trial in North Korea for illegal entry. Yes, the State Department did not rule out such a possibility when asked if it would make sense to send Al Gore, who is chairman of the California TV station Current TV, which employs the two very journalists who were captured and who are on trial in North Korea right now. The two women, Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, are on trial in North Korea on charges that could send them to a labor camp for years. They were detained at the border while researching a story about refugees fleeing the hardline communist state. And in a column published May 9th in the Washington Post, Victor Cha, a former advisor to President George W. Bush on North Korea, suggested that President Barack Hussein, Barry Ho, Obama's administration should send Al Gore to Pyongyang. Victor says, Victor Cha says that Al Gore could go to Pyongyang without fear of setting or breaking diplomatic precedent. He could issue whatever, quote, apologies, unquote, were necessary to secure the two women's release. Mr. Cha reminds us that similar token apologies have been issued in the past, and has Mr. Gore been practicing? We have tape of Mr. Gore practicing his apology to the North Korean regime. Indeed, we do. Let's roll that tape. Mr. Kim, I just want to say that I am so sorry that these two reporters from my television station had blatant disregard for the respect of the borders of your sovereign nation. We are so very, very sorry.
You look like an angel. Walk like an angel. Walk like an angel. Talk like an angel. But I got one. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are.
It's the Weekly Worldview. I'm Doug McBurney back with you as we delve even deeper into the politics file. It's good to see that someone has found something for Al Gore to do besides hyping his cap and trade business. And I want to see those two young ladies released from North Korea. Don't get me wrong. Even if Mr. Gore gets the credit. It's just a sad story. All right, now. Back into the politics file. From the Wall Street Journal, Dateline of Washington, D.C., the Obama administration plans to appoint a special master for compensation to ensure that companies receiving federal bailout funds are abiding by executive pay guidelines. Yes, the administration of Barry Ho is expected to name Kenneth Feinberg, who oversaw the federal government's compensation fund for victims of the September 11th terrorist attacks, to act as a, quote, pay czar, unquote, for the Treasury Department. Yeah. The issue, ladies and gentlemen, companies, including banks, insurers, automakers, are all subject to a host of compensation restrictions imposed by the Bush and Obama administrations and by Congress in regards to all the federal bailout money they've been printing for the last 6 or 8 months or so. And it's interesting. A pay czar in the United States of America. We're supposed to be a free country. We're supposed to be capitalist in political terms, modern political terms. I can just imagine what this would, you know, in the old Soviet Union, I think they had a Kommissar Spetsenkampfensmatz. That was your pay czar over there in the Soviet Union. And folks, once you create an office like this in the federal government, my fear is that it'll just never go away, and pretty soon he'll be the pay czar at Doug McBurney Incorporated, me and my zero employees. Just a fear that I have. You know how it is when these federal positions are created. You know, guy gives it to his cousin, gives it to his brother-in-law, and, you know, 10 years down the road, pretty soon, no, everybody's got to pay what the government say. And I don't like that. I don't like the idea of creating this position. I think they should make this guy make Kenneth Feinberg, give him a post in Belgium or something as the, cultural emissary. You know, just your typical patronage job like they do in Chicago, Barack. Don't create a pay czar, for crying out loud. Special master for compensation. The Kommissar Spetsenkampfensmatz. Anyway, that's not real Russian. I just made that up. All right. Now, delving back into the international file, we have a rather interesting story out of Russia. Russian police have arrested two men who staged audacious robberies in a chic Moscow suburb near the presidential palace after studying satellite images in the area on Google. The men had minutely pored over street pictures hosted on Google Maps, and back on May 21st raided several homes in the Barvika district, including those of lawmakers and businessmen. Yeah, they apparently used night vision goggles and broke into mansions, opening safes and spiriting away cash, jewelry, and designer watches. Yeah, a number of people have pointed out that Google and Google Maps could be used to do nefarious criminal activity and even to inflict harm on people. And here we see that those concerns are indeed true. Now, is it Google's fault that they provide very accurate, timely maps that can be used by criminals? No, it's not Google's fault. I mean, there's a lot wrong with Google in the fact that they're a bunch of tree-hugging, queer-kissing freaks. But the fact that they've made quality maps available to both criminals and hard-working, red-blooded, heterosexual Americans alike, well, it's just not Google's fault. I'm sorry. That's one thing we cannot blame on Google, although the impending collapse of Western civilization may be directly traced in some way to the homo lovers up there at Google. Anyway, but we will continue on in the international file. Now, as I said, we're going to try to divine some of the news of the future based on the news of the week. From Hong Kong, from the AFP wire, Hong Kong officials say they have found traces of cocaine in cans of Red Bull a few days after Taiwanese authorities confiscated close to 18,000 cases of the popular energy drink. Officials have made the claim that indeed they found traces of cocaine in the drink. It's been taken off the shelves there in Hong Kong. Red Bull's Asia-Pacific marketing director said that the firm strongly disputes the findings. He says, quote, "It would have been absolutely impossible for the Hong Kong or any other authorities to have found traces of cocaine in Red Bull energy drink." He says, "We expect the Hong Kong authorities to recognize their error soon." Now, this story's, 6 days old now? And I still have not heard the Hong Kong authorities retract their allegations. And, in fact, I believe that Germany has pulled Red Bull. And, I don't know what to think. I myself, I don't drink Red Bull. I tried one of those energy drinks. I felt like I was drinking Karo syrup with Kool-Aid mixed with it. Just awful. Awful stuff. It didn't seem to give me a lot of energy either. It made me want to puke. Red Bull, by the way, Red Bull's advertising slogan is "Red Bull gives you wings." Oddly enough. And it's a dominant player in the global energy drinks market. So there's a big energy drinks market out there. I'm sure it's a multi-billion dollar market. And I'm looking into the future and I'm wondering how long will it be before the Western liberal democracies, of which the United States is now one. We are a socialist Western liberal democracy now. We're not the land of the brave and the home of the free anymore. We're just an also-ran liberal democracy in the EU format. Anyway, how long will it be until we actually tolerate speed drinks where the cocaine's in there, the methamphetamine's in there? It just doesn't matter. Just go for it, man. And my prediction is that before I turn 50 years old, that there will be speed drinks. Of course, they won't call them speed drinks. They'll probably still call them energy drinks. But they'll be laced with all kinds and every manner of mind-altering substance that you can imagine. And I'm predicting that to happen sometime within the next 10 years. So we'll just see. A friend of mine actually predicted that at some point, an entertainer on stage or perhaps a sports figure on the field would be shot and killed. Yeah, he predicted that that would happen eventually as our insatiable appetite for mind-numbed entertainment just grows and grows and grows. So I predict the speed drinks will come before the assassination of a rock singer or a hip-hop artist. Well, maybe not a hip-hop artist. Let's wait on that. But before a sports figure or a rock star is killed on stage, or on the field, I believe that the speed drinks will be legal and tolerated. All right. Now, let's dive into the culture file. Dateline Biscayne Park, Florida. A popular Miami priest nicknamed Father Oprah said that, quote, church is about forgiveness, unquote, during his first sermon since leaving the Roman Catholic Church to become an Episcopalian, amid an uproar over published photos of him kissing his girlfriend on the beach. Oh, my, a Catholic priest kissing his girlfriend on the beach. Now, this priest, his name is the Right Reverend Alberto Coutier. And Coutier has said that his decision to switch from Roman Catholic to Episcopalian was made over time and was not necessarily just a result of the photos that were exposed in a Spanish language magazine down South Florida, and has just sent just shockwaves of outrage throughout the South Florida Spanish-speaking community. By the way, down in South Florida, the Right Reverend Alberto Coutier, he was known for his good looks and as the host of a TV show in which he gave relationship advice, earning him the Father Oprah moniker. You know, before this happened, one would have thought, how could a priest, a celibate single priest, be giving relationship advice? Seems sort of ironic, until you realize he was actually carrying on a relationship, and he had some idea of that of which he spoke. By the way, he was removed from his Miami Beach Catholic parish after photos surfaced, him kissing his girlfriend back there in early May. And I've got to say, to the Catholic hierarchy there in the archdiocese, at least the guy was kissing a girl. I mean, that's some progress on the part of your failing church. At least it was a female, and she was of age. You know, that's something. By the way, I often wonder if the folks in the archdiocese, or the folks in the Catholic Church, the folks running that whole calliope, have they ever read the book of Matthew in chapter 8 where Jesus heals Peter's wife's mother? Wasn't Peter the first pope? And if Peter's wife had a mother that was healed by Jesus, wouldn't that imply that Peter was married? I'm just saying, okay? I'm pretty sure that the whole priest not being allowed to be married thing actually originated sometime in the Middle Ages, and it was more about the Catholic Church's acquisition of land via the marrying off of their priests to wealthy landowning families. And, you know, if you want your church to survive, number one, you should start reading your Bible. Number two, you should realize that salvation is about a relationship with Jesus Christ, and it's not about your religious tradition. I always got creeped out in the Catholic Church. I got to tell you, my grandmother was Catholic, and some of my earliest memories as a very young child are of going to grandmother's house and looking up on the wall above the fireplace, and there's a picture of a bloody, battered Jesus Christ hanging on the cross. And I have to say that that had a negative impact on my young psyche. I remember looking up at that and thinking, that's freaky. That's just weird. What's up with that? I mean, I went to church. We had a cross at our church. But, you know, we didn't hang the bloody, beaten body of our Savior on that cross because, frankly, that's not what we celebrated at our church. And I often wondered at that tender young age, what is it that's going on at these Catholic churches? Because that is just weird. I don't want to see that. All right. So are we done with the Catholics? Indeed, we are done with the Catholics. Okay. Now let's jump into the culture file. Back into the culture file. A funny, funny story about the public schools. Over there in Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, by the way, this story is from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, a police officer used a stun gun on a high school student who refused to stop talking on a cell phone and pushed the officer. Yeah, a student was walking up and down a hallway using a cell phone. School policy permits students to have cell phones but not to use them during school except in emergencies. That's according to the police chief there. Now, a Penn Hills police officer who just happened to be at the school. Why is that? Because at public schools, they have armed police officers now. Because who knows what's going to happen at any given moment. That's just the reality of public school. There is an armed police officer there at the public schools. Anyway, the police officer told this kid walking down the hall, he told him, put your phone away and go to class. Well, the kid refused to listen. The officer took him by the arm and said, you have to go to the office. And the student resisted and pushed the officer, so the officer whipped out his stun gun and did what they call a drive stun. Now, for those of you in the audience who are not police officers like myself and don't know what a drive stun is, it involves pushing the taser against a portion of the body and squeezing the trigger, thus immobilizing a portion of the body, such as the leg. Isn't that interesting? It must be a lot of fun to hang around at a high school with a stun gun. There's a lot of kids who could use that. Anyway, while on the floor, the student was still resisting and was placed in handcuffs. Yeah. Now, the student later complained of a headache and dizziness, and he was taken to the hospital. That's it. I mean, that's the story. That's the modern public schools today here in the United States of America. Isn't that just delightful? Now, let's one more from the culture file before we go to break. Dateline Washington, D.C., from the Associated Press. Former Vice President Dick Cheney said he supports men being able to marry sheep, but believes the states and not the federal government should make the decision. Well, I got that. Okay, you're right. I got that wrong. He says he supports gays being able to marry, but he believes that it's a state issue and not a federal issue. There really wasn't anything about sheep in there. Unless we're divining out into the future as to what the news will be. And it'll be long after Dick Cheney's dead, but his daughter will one day endorse the idea of men marrying sheep. Anyway, Dick Cheney said, "I think, you know, freedom means freedom for everyone. I think people ought to be free to enter into any kind of union they wish and any kind of arrangement they wish." Cheney, who, according to the Associated Press, has a gay daughter, and that doesn't mean she's happy, ladies and gentlemen. No, it means she's homosexual. He says that marriage has always been a state issue. That's what Dick Cheney says, and your average brain-dead Republican sits there and nods and says, "Yes, Dick, that's right, it's a state issue." And I'm thinking, have any of these people read the book of Genesis, for crying out loud? The second chapter, even. You don't even have to read the whole book. Just go through the first couple chapters, long before the state was ever established. God said that a man will leave his mother and father and be married to his wife. It's not a state issue, you moron. Dick Cheney. He said, what else did Dick have to say? "And I think that that's the way it's got to be handled today. That is, on a state-by-state basis. Different states will make different decisions, but I don't have any problem with that. I think people ought to get a shot at that." What does that mean, "I think people ought to get a shot at that"? And especially coming from Dick Cheney, for crying out loud. You start using language like that, people are going to start leaving the room, Dick. He went on to make a number of points about Guantanamo Bay and da-da-da-da-da. Let's see here. And well, according to the story, he apparently never actually mentioned sheep, but stay tuned. And I am your host, Doug McBurney, and it's so good for you to be with us here. We should probably do this show daily because there's just no way I can get through all this news. There's just no way. It cannot be done. And we may take the show daily someday. Out in the future, if I'm able to build an audience somehow by blind, stupid luck and people actually start to follow the show like you're doing right now, thank you very much, then we'll probably turn this thing into a subscription service, and this is all I will do, is sit in the basement and crack jokes with my wife and read the news. Yeah, wouldn't that be great? It'd be a great way to make a living. Okay, are we done with Dick Cheney? Yes, we are done with Dick Cheney. He has officially been laid to the side. Now, back into the culture file. We just talked about the public schools, right, where the kid got tased. Where was that? Yeah, kid was using his cell phone and he got stun gunned, or he got tased in the popular vernacular. Well, listen to this and tell me who in this story needs to be tased. Dateline Burlington, Vermont. Vermont teenagers are participating in an after-school program focused on gender. Now, in the long-distant past, gender was a grammatical term, and indeed, one would have thought that at times there were after-school programs for your particularly dense kids who just couldn't get it with the grammar, and you just had to sit there and explain gender, and you use examples, and you study, and you write, and you read, and eventually the kid hopefully leaves the program and he understands what gender's all about. But ladies and gentlemen, gender doesn't mean gender anymore in the traditional grammatical sense. No, indeed. The 9-week program there in Burlington, Vermont, which is partially funded by the Burlington School District, was held at Vermont's Queer Youth Center, and it's called Gendertopia. Yeah. Gay, lesbian, and straight students discussed a wide range of topics from the characters in the book and movie Twilight to taking photos around the city that showed the different ways gender is portrayed in the popular culture. All right. So whoever's sitting on the Burlington School District, somebody needs to take a taser to them, for crying out loud. Anyway, I find this interesting. Gay, lesbian, and straight students discussed da-da-da, right? That's the AP story. So you notice that gay students and lesbian students are mentioned first, and then they throw in the straight students. They're mentioned third. You know why? Because they're probably the dwindling population, for crying out loud. Pretty soon there won't be any more. If you leave it up to the Burlington School District, for crying out loud, you're going to turn all the boys queer. And then what are we going to do with Vermont? It'll have to be a part of England or something. Anyway, I have a quote from a poor young man who's been the victim of the Burlington School District and the public school system in general. A young lad named David Kingsbury. He's a 16-year-old junior at Burlington High School. And he signed up for the program, probably hoping he would meet girls. Big mistake there, Dave. Anyway, he says, quote, "Most people come into the course thinking, oh, there's two genders and two sexualities. People assume it's boy and girl. But it's so much more than that. There's a whole world out there filled with different genders." Unquote. Oh, Dave. Say it ain't so, Dave. You're only 16, man. Anyway, just a warning to all you, anyone out there with kids, for crying out loud, don't put them in the public schools. If you do, you are sinning against your Creator and the living God of the universe, who will judge your eternal soul. Just keep that in mind before you pack your kids off to the public school factory, where they're going to be turned into a bunch of flaming queers. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of what they're going to do to your kids. All right, let's set aside Vermont. Indeed. Unless someone has a stun gun on them right now. You know, then we could go and address the Burlington School District. all right. Now that was a tale from the public schools. Now I'm going to tell you a tale about my experience homeschooling as it relates to cavemen, okay? And let me just read the story first, and then I'll tell you how this relates to my life and my homeschooling experience with my brilliant 7-year-old daughter, Nicole. Anyway, this is a story about the LA County authorities raiding a cave in Los Angeles. That's right. And this is from the Los Angeles Times. It's about the size of two high school gyms placed side by side, and the cave is both an invisible squatters camp and a shooting gallery for drug users. The California Department of Transportation has tried repeatedly to seal it shut, but police didn't realize people were still living there until March, when a University of Southern California journalism student researching homelessness spotted the opening in the underpass near the San Gabriel River in Baldwin Park. I saw this story on television, ladies and gentlemen, and it's quite freaky and bizarre, because they are indeed caves, but they're all man-made caves. They're underneath the freeway, for crying out loud. But here we have cavemen in Los Angeles, California. Now, listen to the description of the police entry of the Los Angeles cave. Guns drawn, deputies stepped through the opening into the darkness. Flashlight beams picked up mounds of scrap, metal, bicycle parts, knives, syringes, and an M16 ammo clip. They found thick sections of concrete wall had been chiseled away to create little rooms. They found a man sleeping near the rotting carcass of what appeared to be a cat. Now, that's just, I mean, this is the year 2009, Los Angeles, California, ladies and gentlemen. Sheriff's Deputy Paul Archambault said, quote, "It looks like a baby was living in here. It looks like they had a nursery or something. There's a bunch of rattles and toys and stuff. I think they put the babies up there to keep them away from the rats." The rats, he said, to keep the babies away from the rats. These are cavemen in Los Angeles, circa 2009. What else did the sheriff's deputy have to say? Oh, he says there were two nurseries, he said. There was a dead cat in one of them. It looked like they had skinned it and ate it. They had a little barbecue set up. It's just wicked in there, he said. He estimated that 30 squatters had been living there, and he called it a hidden city. So, anyway, my daughter, she reads both religious and secular sources of historical information, and I've built into her the habit of doubting just about everything she reads about the history of the world. She has serious doubts whenever she reads it. And so she'll often turn to me and she'll say, "Dad, was it really 84 million years ago that this dinosaur lived?" And I'll say, "No, dear, it wasn't 84 million years ago. Good question." And at some point when we were reading some secular account of history, it talked about cavemen. And she said, "Daddy, were there really cavemen?" And, you know, because she doubts a great deal of what's held to be legitimate scientific theory and even fact. And so I gave her my theory of cavemen. I said, "Nicole, indeed, there were cavemen. In fact, in a number of civilizations throughout the history of the universe, various portions of society have degraded themselves via sin and immorality until they were reduced to the level of living in caves with dogs, for crying out loud. So yes, as you look around the world, you will find evidence of people who dwelled in caves. But that in no way reflects on what the civilization about them was all about." And here we have proof of my theory, for crying out loud. It's Los Angeles, California, 2009. We found cavemen. Now, these cavemen are a little different. You know, they're not necessarily scratching hieroglyphics on the walls, although they very well may be. You know, they're all whacked out on drugs and drawing pictures on the walls and skinning and eating cats and putting their babies up high so they don't get eaten by the rats. They're cave people. So, you know, 500 years from now, somebody stumbles across this cave. Are we to assume from that Los Angeles was a cave-dwelling society? In some respects, it may be true that Los Angeles is a cave-dwelling society. Well, at least in this respect. I don't want to cast aspersions on our brothers and sisters out there in the beautiful state of California and the wonderful city of Los Angeles itself. But, hey, you got cavemen in your midst, okay? That's all I'm saying. It's just bizarre. Cavemen in Los Angeles. I mean, that's why if you read the Bible, you realize it only takes one generation for a society to completely lose all of its cultural advancement and end up dwelling in caves with dogs guarding the door, dressing yourself in animal skins. It could happen, ladies and gentlemen. It could happen in Los Angeles. We have to be careful. That's why I homeschool my children so that they will be able to hopefully be a reservoir of cultural advancements that we've made up to this point. At least the big picture, okay? All right, now, we're running out of time, as I knew we would. I knew we'd run out of time, and there's no way we're going to be able to do all this. I got a story from a listener, Richard Richmond, out of Montreal, and it talks about a Canadian chap and his common-law wife who went to Montreal's Royal Victoria Hospital, believing that they had plenty of time to spare. She was due. She was going to have a baby. Well, they talked to the doctor. The doctor, according to the story from the Canadian press, was convinced that the mother would give birth late the next day. And so they crashed out there at the hospital, this guy and his common-law shack-up wife. Just the chick he was shacking up with and happened to impregnate, I guess. I mean, it's Canada. We don't want to offend anybody. This gentleman, his name was Mark. At about 4:55 in the morning, Mark started pressing the call button because his wife was going into labor. And he says the nurse came by, poked her head in the door, and said, "I'll be with you in just a little bit." Well, 10 minutes later, she's full on in delivery, and he's pushing the button like a madman. He knew something was wrong. He says in the story, "I don't know how many times I pushed that button, but it was quite a bit." And then his wife told him, "Hey, I can feel the head." And he says he freaked out. He reached down, put his hand on the kid's chest and the other hand on the kid's head and just pulled him out. And, well, the hospital there in Montreal, they're a bit embarrassed that this gentleman had to pound on the call button and no nurse came, and he ended up delivering the kid himself. A director of professional services at the hospital says, "We understand the distress of the parents and feeling that there was some problem in accessing care when events suddenly precipitated." Yeah. Now, the hospital, they're embarrassed. They say they're going to meet with the parents. They were scheduled to meet them sometime this past week. Now, we don't know if the hospital staff was able to make it to that meeting, but they certainly weren't able to make it to the delivery of the child. And why is that, do you think? Well, you know, Mr. Barry Ho has now, he's nationalized the banks. He's nationalized a couple of the major auto manufacturers. He has nationalized a number of mortgage companies. And he is hell-bent on nationalizing the United States medical care system. He's on his way, ladies and gentlemen. So you can look up here to Montreal. I want to thank Richard Richmond for sending the story. You can look at this story and see what's going to happen when medicine here in the United States becomes socialized like it is up there in Canada. Yeah, I mean, have you seen the Medicare for All commercials with the guy from MASH, Mike Farrell? Have you seen these commercials? It's terrifying. I feel like I'm living in a novel, you know? Has anyone read 1984 by George Orwell? I feel like I'm living in that right now. You got the cavemen in Los Angeles. You got the Medicare for All commercials with the guy from MASH. It's just freakish. Anyway, now you read this story and you start thinking, if they do socialize medicine, maybe home birth will become a legitimate option. Now, me and my wife, we've never had the nerve to go through with the whole home birth thing, but hey, we support it. Fine, if that's what you want to do, then you just go for it. It's just something that I'm a little bit squeamish, to be honest with you. I don't do well with the sight of blood or screaming women or anything like that. And so home birth has never looked like a viable option for me. But as we go forward in Barry Ho's new socialized, Canadianized, utopian America, perhaps, home birth will become an option. Doug McBurney, this is the Weekly Worldview, and I know I shouldn't have let that bump run so long, but I love that guitar lick. Yeah, I just love that guitar lick. I can't help it. That's because it's one of the few guitar licks that I can actually play myself on the guitar. And do you know why that is? Because it came out in the 90s when pretty much everyone forgot how to play guitar. They forgot. So that even a 40-something pudgy guy like me could pick up his guitar and whip off a riff like that because, let's just face it, guitar solos declined significantly in the 1990s, and as far as I can tell, they have not come back. But that's all aside. Are we done with Canada? We are done with Canada. All right, now there is a ton of stuff to get through here in the last 10 minutes or so. This is some funny stuff, some serious stuff. Dateline, Pierre, South Dakota. A gentleman up there, Mr. Neil Wanless, a 23-year-old rancher, won the Powerball jackpot of $232 million, according to this AP story. And he says, quote, "I want to thank the Lord for giving me this opportunity and blessing me with this great fortune. I will not squander it." Now, that's encouraging to hear. from a winner of the lottery. Now, according to the Associated Press, he will take home a lump sum of $88.5 million after taxes are deducted. Did you catch that? He's taken home $88 million. He won $232 million. Anyway, I suppose when there's that much money involved, you're willing to let the government have their take. And I had wondered, why is it that the governments, especially state governments, are so high on the lottery? I mean, they're basically running a numbers game that you would have been arrested for in Brooklyn in the 50s, you know? But that's what they're doing. And now I can see why. I can't do the math in my head, but that's over $100 million that the government gets. It's over $130 million, for crying out loud. It's $150 million that the government gets to keep out of the take. So now I can see why the government is running a numbers racket. Anyway, this young lad, just a good-looking cowboy guy. He had an awesome, like one of those cowboy shirts and the cowboy hat, you know? He looked like a country music, he looked like a presenter at the Country Music Awards or something. But just a good-looking young kid who won $88 million. And the AP tells us, Neil Wanless's winnings are certainly enough to set him and his family up for life, but past lottery winners have burned through vast fortunes in spectacular fashion or found that they were better off before they struck it rich. Now, I like the term that the Associated Press writer chose. The writer says his winnings are certainly enough to set him and his family up for life. Yeah, set him up. Well, it definitely set him up for more than they bargained to get into. The AP tells us, you remember Evelyn Marie Adams, who won the New Jersey lottery twice in the mid-80s, but still managed to lose the entire $5 million fortune? And do you remember West Virginia's Jack Whitaker? Yeah, he won $315 million on Christmas Day 2002, and 5 years later was blaming the money for causing his granddaughter's fatal drug overdose, his divorce, his inability to trust, and hundreds of lawsuits filed against him. Says he lost every friend he ever had after winning the lottery. Anyway, we wish young Neil, what's his name here? Neil Wanless, W-A-N-L-E-S-S, Neil Wanless of Winner, South Dakota. I wonder if Neil is a pro-personhood. I'd like to get in touch with Neil and find out, because he could squander a great deal of his fortune and do something quite useful if he were to get involved in the personhood movement. That's what we need, is a bright young fella who's good-looking and has, you know, several tens of millions of dollars laying around. And he's looking for something to do that's going to, you know, redeem his entire life. Anyway, looks like he's going to buy a ranch and he's going to help his mom and dad, help some folks around town, but that'll probably still leave some money left over. Anyway, I'm against lotteries myself. I think that I think lotteries are a tax on suckers and stupid people. Not to say that Neil is either one of those. Perhaps he was just bored and he bought a lottery ticket. I don't know. But there you have it. We'll see what happens to Neil Wanless. We'll follow the saga out of Winner, South Dakota. Now back into the culture file, and I'm going to have to go fast now. I'm going to have to go really fast. Now this is some serious and ugly stuff here that we're going to get into. Dateline Mesa, Arizona. Police in Arizona say five officers have been placed on paid leave after one flushed a fetus down a toilet. Mesa Police Chief George Gaskin says four officers responding to a call about a possible miscarriage at a motel discovered a woman who apparently lost a fetus estimated to be 12 to 14 weeks old. Gascon says that Lieutenant Lynn Young instructed the four officers over the phone to flush the 4-inch fetus down the toilet rather than take it to a hospital. Now, there were five cops involved. Two of them, well, at least one of them was female, Kristen Johnson. Now, we don't know if Lieutenant Lynn Young was a female or not. I tried to research it, could not find out. The other two cops there were a couple of guys, and they decided to flush a person's body down the toilet, and it's just indicative of the level of respect that your average government official has for life, the life of any given human being. Just a sad story. And now let's get to the requiem there in Wichita that's been going on all week for Tiller the Killer. Hundreds of people gathered Saturday to honor slain abortion provider Dr. George Tiller, and a longtime friend eulogized him as a passionate and generous man who repeatedly overcame difficult challenges. Tiller's funeral at College Hill United Methodist Church also drew a small group of protesters. But, and now that's all the AP gives to the protesters. That's it, is that one line. But during the service, Tiller was remembered for his generosity and his sense of humor. Larry Borcherding of Overland Park, who first met Tiller a half century ago when both were students at University of Kansas, had this to say in the eulogy. Dear God, get heaven ready, because Mr. Enthusiasm is coming. Heaven will never be the same. It will be a better, better place with George in it. That's what George Tiller, the killer's friend, said about him. He didn't just say heaven would be a better place. He said heaven would be a better, better place with George Tiller, and it called him Mr. Enthusiasm. George Tiller. About 700 people, by the way, folks, filled the church, the United Methodist Church, by the way, no surprise there that the United Methodists would hold the funeral. 700 people filled the church sanctuary, and 200 others watched on a closed-circuit television broadcast in another room. Now, Tiller performed third trimester abortions. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not one to celebrate the death of any particular individual and to revel in joy, but I must confess that it feels good to refer to Mr. Tiller's occupation in the past tense. It feels good. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to say that I support the killing of abortionists, because I do not, except when duly convicted by the governing authorities. I do not authorize or support or in any way encourage anyone to take it upon themselves to kill an abortion doctor. I'm just saying it feels good to refer to the fact that George Tiller was a killer in the past tense, because George Tiller didn't do any abortions this week. Not a single one. He didn't. Now, you'll remember, folks, that his clinic was bombed back in 1986, and he was shot in both arms back in 1993. It tells you, folks, he's been driving unstable pro-lifers to the brink for a long, long time because of his particularly vicious practice of chopping up late-term babies. And, oh, by the way, I got a correction from Danielle in the audience. Mr. Tiller did not throw the babies' bodies that he ripped apart and flayed the flesh from the bones. After he did that, he did not throw them in the trash. I was wrong about that. What he did was, the body parts that he didn't sell, he put into an incinerator and he burned them up after he had the family quite often have a memorial service for the child that they had just all participated in murdering. So just a sick, sick, bizarro world that actually it's not. It's not a sick, bizarro world. It's the world today. It's the world where cavemen evolve in Los Angeles. This is the world we live in today. It's a world where men make their living in the heartland butchering and flaying the flesh from living human beings who are completely innocent. That's the world we live in today. It's not bizarro world. It is shocking, but we should not be surprised. Is there more from Wichita? Yes, about 30 abortion rights supporters lined the sidewalk outside the church Sunday, each holding a white carnation, and one with a sign declaring Tiller and his family and his staff as, quote, civil rights heroes, unquote. Many wore green or blue T-shirts commemorating Tiller's life with the National Organization for Women's logo. So for folks at the National Organization of Women, you can be quite proud of yourselves in that you will be indelibly linked to George Tiller's career, whether you want to be or not. And right now you want to be, but a day is going to come. A day is coming when you will not want to be associated with Dr. George Tiller's career, but you are forever. Let's see. That was College Hill United Methodist Church. Their current pastor, Reverend John Martin, said that the grief over the killing of George Tiller is intensified because Tiller was killed in a house of worship. We all know that shootings happen in church. I'm always disconcerted when they do, Martin said. Suddenly, it really struck home. It really struck home? What struck home? That you're a United Methodist pastor and that you're apologizing for a mass murderer and that you're leading your entire flock into eternal torment and separation from the Creator God in a place that we commonly refer to as hell? Did that suddenly struck home? What struck home, Mr. Martin? What struck home? I think I'll ask him that on Judgment Day. Let's see here. Dateline Wichita, Kansas, from the Associated Press. The church where late term abortion provider George Tiller was killed is bringing in counselors to help members and has received supportive messages from around the world, according to their senior pastor. The Right Reverend Lowell Michelson of Reformation Lutheran Church said crisis intervention experts will help people through group and individual counseling. They need counselors. Yeah, because there is a lot of shock and grief. The shock of discovering a mass murderer in the congregation must be terrible. I wonder if there were people, just pew sitters, who went to church every Sunday who had no idea that they were sitting right down the pew from a mass murderer. I wonder. Now, I'm sure you're all aware, Scott Rader, who's a 51-year-old, relatively unstable pro-life guy, has been charged with first-degree murder in the death of Tiller, who was shot in the foyer of the church. Believe he was shot in the head. Hoping to get some clarification on that. I like to keep track of things like that. The pastor there at Reformation Lutheran Church says he's prayed for Rader. And we just got to hope that the Lord won't hold that against Rader. Because the Lord's got a bone to pick with Rader. Let's get that out on the table right now. The Lord's not happy with Mr. Rader taking justice into his own hands and murdering an abortion doctor. But hopefully the Lord won't hold the fact that this deviant, disgusting, on his way to hell with jet rockets pastor is actually praying for him. I don't think the Lord will hold that against him. One more from Wichita. The clinic of slain Kansas abortion provider George Tiller will reopen after a week of mourning. That means this week, folks. They say they're going to reopen the clinic. That's what they say. One of four doctors who performed abortions at Tiller's clinic said that operations will resume this week. Let's see. Flowers were placed outside the clinic. The flag flew at half staff. An anti-abortion group sign said that members prayed for Tiller to change his views, but not for his murder. And I'm with them. I never prayed for his murder. As I said, I would have preferred a trial and a duly adjudicated execution. Dr. Leroy Carhart of Bellevue, Nebraska, has worked at Tiller's clinic for 10 years. He said Tiller set up a rotation schedule with three other doctors so the clinic could continue, quote, whether he is there in person or in spirit, unquote. Yeah. Now, Tiller's attorney, Tiller's former attorney, it should say, Dan Monnett. Tiller won't be needing an attorney where he's going. He won't be allowed an attorney, as a matter of fact. Tiller's former attorney, Dan Monnett, said it's too soon to know the long-term plans for the clinic, and he noted that federal marshals are protecting the clinic. I heard a rumor that George Tiller's wife is quite possibly on the verge of repentance. It's possible, right? Tiller's wife could quite possibly be on the verge of repentance. We should all pray that she will repent, because for her, there's still hope. For George, as far as we know, there is no hope. He's bound for hell with those jet rockets I mentioned earlier, but his wife could very well repent, and she apparently could close the clinic. Let's hope that that happens, and let's hope that both of those things happen. And let's move on. Okay. Now, this is from the Culture File. Again, we're going to go a little bit long here, folks, and if you don't mind, whatever, just listen to the rest later if you don't have time, but we're going to go a little long because I knew I couldn't get through all this stuff. So this is from Boston, Massachusetts, from the Associated Press. Harvard University is creating a visiting professorship in lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered studies. They don't even include the straight people in there at all. I mean, at least the other school, they let the straights in. Now that it's just all lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, freaks of nature. Anyway, they're endowing this professorship. Is it a professorship? Yes. With a gift of $1.5 million from the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus. Now, Harvard's chair is named for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered studies chair is named for F.O. Matheson, a Harvard scholar. According to the Associated Press, F.O. Matheson was a Harvard scholar and distinguished literary clinic. Clinic, did I say? I'm dwelling on here. All right. He was a Harvard scholar, a distinguished literary critic, and a gay man who died in 1950. Now, that's what the Associated Press tells us, that this chair is being named for a scholar. What they don't tell you is that F.O. Matheson was a socialist communist queer who jumped out of a window at the age of 48 years old and killed himself because he was a demented, deranged, deviant homosexual. I suppose they would say that it was the oppressive culture of the 1950s, the beaver cleaver culture, that drove him to suicide. But it was actually, if you do the research, it was he basically killed himself over another boy that he liked. The guy was a freak. And it's very appropriate that Harvard is going to endow a chair for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered freak and nature studies after this deviant freak. It's just appropriate. The university said that it would regularly invite experts in issues related to sexuality or sexual minorities to teach on campus for one semester. The Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus advocates for gay and lesbian students, faculty, and alumni, and if they have it their way, everybody! They want everybody to turn queer! There at the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus. So folks, this drove me to do a little bit of research, and I pulled out Harvard's original charter. From the year, I didn't write down the year. It's like 1647 or something. Back there in the 1600s. And it says, whereas through the good hand of God, Harvard College may conduce to the education of the English and Indian youths of this country in knowledge and godliness. That's their original charter. That's how it reads in part. I paraphrased. I left out a lot of stuff because it has to do with people giving gifts and sundry gifts, land and buildings and all this. But they said it was for the education of the English and Indian youth of this country in knowledge and godliness. That was their original charter. So, you know, they're right there. Harvard is we practically have cavemen evolving at Harvard, for crying out loud. It's just unbelievable. All right, now, we're going to jump into the domestic tranquility file. We're going to go through that very quickly. Because it's quite disturbing, and I don't want to dwell on it, but you know that I have to report on this every week. Dateline Syracuse, New York. A Cornell University graduate student from New Zealand has been charged with murdering his wife, whose body was found along a wooded trail in a state park with her throat slashed. Blodzedge Kott is the man's name. He was charged with second-degree murder in the slaying of 28-year-old Carolyn Coffey, a biomedical researcher at the Ivy League University. The guy tried to kill himself as he was taken into custody, but he failed to do so. Dateline Aravaca, Arizona. Authorities say a home invasion in a rural southern Arizona community has left a man and a young girl dead and a woman wounded. Pima County Sheriff says 4 to 5 people forced their way into the home in Aravaca and shot the victims. The girl was about 9 years old. The wounded woman, who apparently shot back at the killers at some point during the altercation, was taken to the hospital. Authorities are searching for the attackers. At least one of them is a woman. Aravaca is about 60 miles south of Tucson, 10 miles north of the Mexican border. Not a lot of domestic tranquility along the Mexican border. Dateline Chicago, Illinois, from the Associated Press. Last week, Chicago had 7 shooting deaths in a 24-hour period over last weekend. And police say they have no suspects in custody. All 7 victims were men in their 20s and 30s, and all were shot to death. The shootings span the city, happening in the north, south, and west sides. Police Superintendent Jody Weiss spoke at an anti-violence march and rally on the west side as the violence was erupting all over the city. So the police spokesgirl, Jody, was speaking at an anti-violence march and rally as the city basically erupted into bloodshed, violence, and cavemen shot each other, butchered each other in the streets. A Dateline Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, this story is in the domestic tranquility file. Philadelphia's police commissioner said Thursday he will not pursue criminal charges against a group of angry neighbors who beat a man sought for questioning in the rape of an 11-year-old girl. The commissioner said he made the decision based on the severity of the man's head and face lacerations. He determined that the neighbor's intent was to bring the man to police, and the high level of emotion in the community after the girl's brutal attack led the crowd to, well, they beat the guy up a little bit. He's a rape suspect, 11-year-old girl. The girl had just dropped off a sibling at daycare and was walking to school when a man approached her. He started to walk with her, threatened her, said he had a gun. He took her to a nearby backyard and assaulted her repeatedly. A day later, after police had handed out photos identifying this dirtbag, what's this guy's name? I want to get his name out there. His name is 26-year-old Jose Carrasquillo. Yes, Jose Carrasquillo. Police handed out photos identifying Carrasquillo as a person of interest. Neighbors spotted the guy on the street. He ran, and they caught him. And they turned him into the police, thankfully. Now, more from the domestic tranquility file. From the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I don't even know if I want to do this story. I'm going to do it, but I don't want to. A 17-year-old male was arrested on charges of aggravated rape and first-degree murder of an 8-month-old child. The infant, Devon Lanza, was taken to Ochsner West Bank Hospital, where he was pronounced dead shortly after arrival. This dirtbag's name is Arnold T. Ross, murderer. He said he was the boyfriend of the infant's mother. Now, Ross has a record of previous arrests for possession of crack cocaine and marijuana, obscenity, battery on a corrections officer, 3 counts of battery on a teacher, 3 counts of theft, illegal carrying of a weapon, and assault. That's the rap sheet of this someone's son. He's 17 years old. He's someone's son. And that brings us to our Bible verse of the week. Warning, warning, and danger, Will Robinson. There are Bible verses up ahead. For those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity, we know here at the Weekly Worldview that it is not in you to tolerate anyone who would dare quote a Bible verse in public, so this warning gives you notice, fair notice even, that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered, and we'll read from the book of Deuteronomy in the 21st chapter, starting at the 18th verse. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him, and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of his city. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious, he will not obey our voice, he is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Now, a lot of biblical critics have criticized this particular verse. Basically, it says that if your son eats too much and gets drunk, that you should have him stoned to death with stones. But I say that you don't understand the Bible, you ignorant morons. This Bible verse, Deuteronomy 21:18, is talking about this very guy right here, Arnold T. Ross, of Jefferson Parish, Louisiana. This 17-year-old with a rap sheet as long as your arm, who finally has assaulted, brutalized, and killed a baby. That's what has happened. Because they have tolerated him through his arrest for possession of crack cocaine and marijuana, obscenity, battery on a corrections officer, 3 counts of battery on a teacher, 3 counts of theft, illegal carrying of a weapon, and assault. All that has been tolerated until now Arnold T. Ross has murdered a baby right there in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana. And folks, that is who Deuteronomy chapter 21 was written for. When the children cry, let the lonely try. Cause when the children sing, then the new world begins. It's the Weekly Worldview. I am Doug McBurney, and we're done with Arnold T. Ross in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana. And we're going to move now into the justice file. Dateline, Lucasville, Ohio, from the Associated Press. A man who burned a woman alive in the trunk of her car was executed on Wednesday in Ohio's first death by lethal injection since the state revised its protocol on the procedure. They've gone to the soft, mushy, cushy, easygoing jazz-laden method of execution, lethal injection, there in Ohio. And one Daniel Wilson, a 39-year-old murderer, was the first to experience that lethal injection there in Ohio. He was sentenced to death, by the way, for the 1991 slaying of acquaintance Carol Lutz, a 24-year-old woman. He locked Lutz in the trunk of her car and then set it on fire after they had spent several hours drinking together at a bar near Cleveland. Now, Daniel Wilson, what did he have to say just before he received his lethal injection? He said, "I am very sorry for what I did to Carol and to my family. I'm sorry things turned out this way. I believe in Jesus. He's my Lord and Savior, and I'm coming home." Now, a lot of people, they don't like it when they hear a convicted murderer make a profession that he's become a Christian right before his execution. But I like it a lot, and let me tell you why, because it's a two-edged sword. First of all, if he really means it, well, then there is hope and there is salvation for this person. He can turn his life around and he can actually become a productive member of society in the world to come. Which, by the way, the world to come lasts forever. Eternity, there's a reason they call it eternity, it lasts forever. And that's why God gives us an opportunity to repent right up until the end. So if he means it, that's great. That means in eternity he's going to be a productive and valuable member of the body of Christ, the community of eternal beings that go on into eternity forever with our Creator. And that's good. And I said it's a two-edged sword. If he doesn't mean it and he's just saying it for effect, then Jesus Christ is going to grind him to an especially fine dust on Judgment Day, and that'll be quite entertaining to watch. So either way, it's a good thing. Trust me, and don't let it bother you. Let's see. Do we have more from this? Let's see. Wilson was baptized as a Roman Catholic last week. All right, well, you know, at least he wasn't baptized as a United Methodist, so there's still some hope. He received communion the morning of his execution. Okay, that's relatively meaningless. Even to Catholics anymore, they just could care less. Wilson spent his final day visiting with his family, friends, and a priest, and called his mother several times overnight. He had a special meal that included a well-done porterhouse steak, baked potato, corn on the cob, salad, strawberry, cheesecake, and a Dr. Pepper. The woman he killed was locked in the trunk of a car, and the car was set on fire, with no last meal and no Dr. Pepper at the end. No Dr. Pepper for the victim. So I'm against that whole idea of the final meal. In fact, I think the execution should take place by surprise. The guy should be given 3 days. And after 3 days, there's a 24-hour period in which we're coming for you. We're not going to tell you when. And then when we come and get you, we're going to yank you out of there, and we're going to hurt you, buddy, okay? We're going to hurt you. And you're going to die in a very painful, very public way. And everyone will hear and fear when they see the brutal vengeance executed upon you by the governing officials after you've been duly convicted of something as heinous as locking a woman in a trunk and setting the car on fire. He should die in some similar fashion, in my humble opinion. By the way, Ohio, according to the AP article, Ohio has put 29 men to death since it reinstated the death penalty in 1999. I did a little research, folks, and I ran some numbers. In 2008, in the four major cities in Ohio, and are there four major cities in Ohio? I think there are. Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, and one other one, big city there in Ohio. I think there's four. Columbus, that's it. All right, in those four cities in 2008, there were 305 murders in 2008. And there have been about 3,000 murders in Ohio since 1999. That's when Ohio reinstated the death penalty. So they've had about 3,000 murders, and they've executed about 30 murderers. So 30. Well, 29, we'll just, to make it easy on the radio. They've had 3,000 murders. They've executed about 30. So 1% of murderers are executed in Ohio. 1 in 100 murderers is executed in Ohio. That's a recipe for disaster in Ohio. And Ohio is one of the states that actually still executes people. But it's a recipe for disaster when your average person contemplating murder figures that there's only a 1 in 100 chance that they're going to be executed for the crime, that perpetuates the idea of murder in the mind of your average deviant scumbag who's considering killing someone. One out of 100. And by the way, that includes about 15 years of life that they have, albeit in prison. They still get baked potatoes, and they still get French fries, and they still are able to sit there and enjoy life to some degree. So 1% of murders, and you'll be taken care of. Just a recipe for disaster there in Ohio. But at least this guy was executed, and that's how that story made it into the justice file. Another one from the justice file. Dateline Rock Hills, South Carolina. Police chief said he thinks officers were justified when they shot a 15-year-old girl suspected of robbing a store at gunpoint. Those comments left the teen's relatives expressing outrage as they planned the girl's funeral. That's right, they shot a 15-year-old girl. Tia Williams, the slain girl's cousin, said, "She ain't nothing but a baby. She ain't even made it to 18 yet." That's what she said. That's terrible grammar. By the way, this reminds me of a story. I'm sitting there one night, I'm watching television with my wife. Now, my wife's from Japan. English is her second language. We're watching a story about a convicted criminal of some sort. And he's talking about, I can't remember if he's talking about his gang life and when he was initiated into the gang and they were basically putting him through a hazing ritual. Yeah, they were putting him through a hazing ritual and it was horrible. And he was basically in some kind of solitary confinement, and they were torturing him. And this gentleman who was relating the story of his gang life, he happened to be of African-American descent. He was a black guy. And he was telling the story of what they did to him. And he was saying that, you know, they held me down, and they hurt me, and they kept on hurting me. And I tried to yell and I screamed for help. And you know how it is when you're screaming, but can't nobody hear you though. And my wife turned to me and said, "What did he just say?" And I had to analyze it. I said, "Well, dear," he said, "can't nobody hear you though." Can't nobody hear you though. And then she said, "Okay, what does that mean?" So anyway, I had to basically translate like from Ebonic gangland into English, meaning that, well, dear, no one, he felt as if no one could hear him, even though he was shouting and yelling. "Can't nobody hear you, though." Anyway, back to the story, and this is a serious story, by the way. The cousin says that the girl hasn't even made it to 18, and the police have shot her. Now, Yvette Williams was shot and killed Thursday afternoon, moments after authorities say she robbed a grocery store. Two officers fired on young Yvette Williams after she pointed a gun at them and refused to drop it. In a nearby neighborhood where Williams lived, members of her large, closely knit family said they were in shock over the teen's sudden death and the police reaction to events. Folks, how can you be shocked that if your kid points a gun at the police and gets herself killed, you should be shocked that your daughter has been killed. That's shocking. But you shouldn't be shocked that the police shot her because she pointed a gun at him. And you can't be pointing a gun at the police. Note to all young kids and adults alike, don't point a gun at the police. They very well may shoot you. Okay, so just a few more stories before we close out. Dateline Riverside, California, from the Associated Press. A convicted arsonist was sentenced to death Friday for setting a Southern California wildfire that killed 5 federal firefighters. Raymond Lee Euler was found guilty in March of 5 counts of first-degree murder for setting the October 2006 blaze 90 miles east of California. Euler's case is believed to mark the first time a death sentence has been ordered in the United States for an arson wildfire involving the deaths of firefighters. Praise the Lord, that's great. But, you know, the mindless system now produces a hint of some small measure of possible justice. Again, 15 years of life before the death penalty is even considered to be... anyway, don't hold your breath, folks. Dateline Conakry in New Guinea. Lawlessness in the capital has risen in recent months with soldiers accused of being among the main culprits of robberies and assaults. And the military's government's anti-crime chief told the citizens, quote, "I'm asking you to burn all armed bandits who are caught red-handed committing an armed robbery." Wow. Burn them, he says. Human rights groups were unhappy with this idea of the military government's crime chief to burn all armed bandits who are caught red-handed committing armed robbery. I'd have to say that on the face of it, that I agree with him. Although burning can be quite inconvenient, there's probably easier ways to get it taken care of. From the International File, Dateline Canberra, Australia. A student fell with a noose around his neck during a mock class hanging that was arranged by teachers. Yeah. Students and teachers rushed to the boy and cut the rope when he fell. The student was allowed to go home with his mother after being examined by paramedics. They were under the supervision of a teacher. They were photographing a staged hanging as part of an English class project. I'm not sure how that all works out, but anyway, there is no known connection currently to the David Carradine case, as far as we know. By the way, David Carradine, he was in Thailand, right? Was he friends with Michael Hutchins, that guy from NXS? Did they ever pal around together? Anyway, basically, folks, government schools are dangerous. Whether in Australia or the United States, they're dangerous on many levels. And so is becoming a maniacal deviant, whether you're in Bangkok or singing for NXS, I suppose. I don't know. Perhaps some sort of rope regulations, rope control, should be considered by the government here in America before something like this happens on our shores. Well, I can assure you that Barney Frank is probably working on it as we speak. So worry not. All right, that's it for the Weekly Worldview, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being with us. As usual, I want to thank everyone who makes the show happen, the folks at American Right to Life, KGOV.com Radio, the folks at Denver Bible Church, Personhood USA and all the work they do, everybody out at Theology Online, and of course, my other brother, Daryl, who helps make it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I will be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.